A utility company wants a federal bailout. They say if they don't get it, the grid will be in jeopardy. But that's not what others are saying.
We have more power generation capability than we need. In fact, 10% more.
I'm Kara Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, will the Department of Energy throw a life jacket to a power company that relies on coal and nuclear energy? And a new organization will put birds front and center on the shores of Lake Erie.
I see people casting around trying to find meaning in their lives, and I just think there's so much meaning that can come from studying birds, from appreciating birds.
Plus, birders have big love for little saw-whet owls.
3 inches tall, maybe 2 to 3 ounces in weight. Just cute. Absolutely cute. So.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. The plan to build a facility to treat wastewater from fracking in Potter County at the headwaters of the Allegheny River appears to be a no-go. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant has more.
It's been a tough week for Epiphany Allegheny. Just days after the financial backer and main customer of its proposed plant, JKLM Energy, announced that it was backing out of the project, Epiphany also lost local support. In a special meeting, the Countersport Area Municipal Authority, or CAMA, voted to terminate all permits and end lease involvement in Epiphany's plant.
I was absolutely shocked.
Lori Barr started a group called Save the Allegheny to oppose the project. Epiphany proposed to distill wastewater from shale gas drilling and then route 42,000 gallons a day through the Countersport sewage plant, which releases treated water into the Allegheny. The river is a source of drinking water for millions of people, including Pittsburgh.
I was very happy that the CAMA board pulled out, but I was very surprised that they did also.
Board members said once JKLM pulled out of the project, there wasn't another customer, so they rescinded the permits. Many citizens at the meeting, including members of the Seneca Nation, cheered the decision. An attorney for Epiphany did not respond to an email for comment. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
There's a new initiative for birds at Presque Isle State Park, and I went there to Lake Erie to learn more from two of its founders. Mary Birdsong is a shorebird monitor here, and as we try to identify birds on the bayside of the park, she lets me peer through her magnifying scope.
I can get better looks if Sarah moves.
More magnification, yeah, sorry.
Sarah Sargent is an avian ecologist. And we're all looking out onto the water at a large white bird with a long neck, a great egret.
The detail on the feathers is amazing. Just the little wisp of wind going through the feathers.
Yeah. They're called ornamental plumes. This is the breeding season, beginning of it, and they've got the plumes ready to go.
That's amazing. I would do this all day if I had one of these.
We do.
This year, Birdsong and Sargent, along with their colleague Laura Marie Koich, founded the Erie Bird Observatory. There's been bird banding here on Presque Isle since 1960, when the permits were under the local Stull and Lieberman families. Banding is when birds are caught, tagged, and tracked during migration. After a lull of a couple of years, Audubon, Pennsylvania picked the program back up in 2007 at the request of the park. So they have data from more than 50 years.
There have been probably close to 100,000 birds banded here over that time span.
Sarah Sargent worked for Audubon, Pennsylvania until they closed their office in the region last year. But she, Birdsong, and Koich wanted to continue their programs. So they started the nonprofit.
The three of us decided, why not?
But also seeing the opportunity to do a lot more here and to build more community involvement with birds here and more focus on this region a little bit. You know, this is actually a premier birding location, and it's underappreciated. I mean, it's known, we actually get international birders here, but not everybody knows about it.
Why do you think Erie is underappreciated?
The Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources has done a beautiful job running the park itself, but they have so many different constituents that they have to speak to, whether it's recreation or boating or fishing, and birding has kind of been a little bit under the radar. The programs that were taking place here were not based here. now the Erie Bird Observatory has the opportunity to be place-based outreach and education.
I'd like to build up a young ornithologists program for high school and college students to get them interest and develop skills in them about how to do different ornithological field techniques, you know, potentially having them go into science and become ornithologists, which may sound like it's a really obscure thing, but birds are very conspicuous. Birds are relatively easy to study, and it is one of the bigger areas for employment in ecology and natural resource management, is people who have bird skills can get jobs.
Mary, you've been a shorebird monitor here for a number of years, and last year was a particularly exciting season. There was nesting piping plovers here in Presque Isle. Talk a little bit about that and how it sort of fits into the new organization.
Yes, 2017 was a very exciting year. Previously, I had only reported the presence of piping plovers, and this last year I got to actually watch over the first successful nest in more than 50 years. And we actually had a second nest that was unfortunately washed out, but the eggs were saved and transferred to Michigan to a captive rearing facility where they're prepared to care for eggs. And the Erie Bird Observatory is hoping to, of course, oversee the continued monitoring, hopefully maybe in getting more nesting piping plovers. And of course, we would like to see very much common terns nesting here as well. They've tried a few times to create a colony. We've never had a successful fledge, but we're hoping to look for ways to improve the situation for them so that they can also nest here again like they used to.
Talk a little bit about the diversity of species and habitats that are here.
Well, there's more than 330 species of birds have been recorded here at Presque Isle State Park. Needless to say, my favorite are the shorebirds. On any regular beach, people might be able to see spotted sandpipers because they do nest along some of the beaches here, and they're fun to watch. They have brown backs and spotted chests, and they kind of run around within the waves a little bit.
This is where we get the sand dunes and the, I don't know, there's some technical terms for the different vegetation types that occur in this one place. As Presque Isle formed over the millennia, you get these enclosed ponds, and then they slowly fill in with marshy vegetation. And so there's a lot, I think there's something like 2,000 acres of wetlands in the park here. These emergent marshes are a fairly rare type of habitat in Pennsylvania because we are a very heavily forested state, like cattail marshes, if people can envision that. And so these are places that have very specialized birds that use only those habitats for breeding. Presque Isle actually now has, I think, probably the biggest population of least bitterns in Pennsylvania, which is this miniature heron, basically. When the park first started doing a lot of invasive plant control, they were targeting the Phragmites, the common reed, this very tall thing with plumed top. They really started attacking it because it had invaded and taken over the wetlands, the marshes. So we actually did marsh bird monitoring in 2011 prior to the beginning of that effort. And then again last year we did another survey, so we were able to compare. And so last year there was a lot more marsh bird, which is exciting to know that the restoration efforts are really working. And that in particular, the least bittern, a very rare species throughout Pennsylvania, is about three times as many now as there were back in 2011.
What are some other things that people might see?
During spring migration, it's one of the best times to get up here. Really, the month of May is best, because all of these very brightly colored small songbirds are migrating through. And these are the long and short distance migrants that are going up to Canada into the spruce forests to breed. Many of them are really brightly colored and really cute looking. So that's one of the things we do during our bird bandings. We show people what these birds actually look like up close and personal, and people love it. We can get 25 species of warblers. Yellow warblers here are just gorgeous little birds that are bright yellow, look like a canary or something. So you can definitely see those in any kind of shrubby area around water.
This is a lot of work, organizing a nonprofit status, getting a board together, volunteers, the actual work that you're going to be doing, doing the banding and the monitoring. Why is this important to you, Mary?
Many years ago, I met Jean Stahl, who was one of the banders at the park. She became a bird mentor to me. I was already interested in birds, but she really got me sucked in. And after she died, I was missing her a lot, and I wrote in my journal that I would do what I could to continue her legacy. And I consider this a continuation.
How do I follow that? It is a personal statement of values and passion, I guess, for me as well, in that I just feel like this is something that just enriches the world so much. And I see people, casting around, trying to find meaning in their lives. And I just think there's so much meaning that can come to people from studying birds. To me, it's really a natural first step into learning and appreciating more about the natural world, and also particularly about human influences and what we can do to help make things better instead of always creating problems in the natural world.
Sarah Sargent is the Erie Bird Observatory's executive director, and Mary Birdsong is an assistant director. And they say they're looking for volunteers. I talked with them at the Tom Ridge Environmental Center at Presque Isle for our new series, Wild PA. There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. Later, we'll hear about another bird banding program near Pittsburgh. Who? What? Or should I say, what? Stay tuned to find out. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapel. The recent bankruptcy of an Ohio power company is the latest sign that coal and nuclear plants are struggling. First Energy is also making an unusual request of the Trump administration, and it appears to have the president's ear. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier explains.
On a recent trip to West Virginia, President Trump told a coal-friendly crowd about a special request the Department of Energy had gotten.
The miners are happy. And we'll be looking at that 202. You know what a 202 is, right? We'll be looking at that. We're trying.
The night before Trump said that, he reportedly attended a fundraiser with a First Energy lobbyist. The company would not confirm that. But we do know that First Energy's coal and nuclear plants in Ohio and Pennsylvania are struggling to compete against cheap natural gas. So now First Energy has asked the Department of Energy to declare a 202 grid emergency. Actually, technically, it's a 202C. Ari Pesco is an electricity law professor at Harvard.
This provision of the law was specifically written by Congress in 1935 to assure that electricity supply did not have the sort of problems that arose during World War I.
The law has also been used to keep plants running during events like hurricanes or when a lightning strike knocked out a power plant last year. But First Energy wants Energy Secretary Rick Perry to use his sweeping powers to make customers in Pennsylvania and surrounding states pay more for electricity from coal and nuclear. So what's the emergency? First Energy declined interview requests. But the company has already announced plans to close Beaver Valley nuclear plant near Pittsburgh and two other nuclear plants in Ohio. It says without help, other plants will close too, and blackouts will come to the electric grid servicing the Mid-Atlantic. The head of that grid, the PJM Interconnection, is worried long-term about plant closures. But CEO Andy Ott says because of new natural gas plants, there's really no danger of power outages.
We have an oversupply situation. We have more power generation capability than we need. In fact, 10% more.
Many call the emergency request a long shot. Environmental groups, oil and gas companies, and rival utilities all oppose it.
You know, this request is kind of like a, you know, half-court shot at the buzzer, right?
Sam Walsh worked in the Department of Energy in the Obama administration. First, he says First Energy's request would shake up the competitive energy market. He also thinks the company's situation is a bad fit for Section 202C. It's asking for 4 years of economic aid using a law designed for temporary fixes to the grid.
I think that there they're really, really stretching it. You know, that is a very, very broad action that they're asking DOE to take.
But this idea of subsidizing coal and nuclear plants, it keeps coming up. Last year, another company, Murray Energy, asked Energy Secretary Perry to invoke the 202C provision. The company is FirstEnergy's biggest coal supplier, and its owner, Bob Murray, is a big Trump backer. Perry did not do it then, but last year, he came up with his own subsidy plan, which federal regulators shot down. Perry has said that the emergency measure 202C might not be the most efficient way to help coal and nuclear plants, but he clearly wants to help them. The only question is how. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Until recently, not a lot was known about saw-whet owls migrating through our region. But a monitoring project is changing that and creating new bird enthusiasts in the process.
I actually released one, and my mom and me had to hold up my arm because the owl didn't want to leave. They have really sharp nails.
Later on the Allegheny Front, volunteers brave the cold and night to get to know a little owl with sharp nails. Stay tuned. Scott Pruitt has been a controversial administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency pretty much since day one. But in the last couple of weeks, that's been magnified by scandals, one after another, which have left many wondering if his days at EPA are numbered. Pruitt's had to defend himself against reports of first-class travel, pricey office furniture, and pay raises for his staff, plus that rented room inside a gas industry lobbyist's house. So while all of this is going on, what about his actions, his effectiveness at EPA? For our podcast, Trump on Earth, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier talked with Emily Atkin, a writer at the New Republic, about Pruitt's job as America's top environmental regulator.
Emily, let's cut to the chase a little bit. Why does Scott Pruitt still have a job?
I think that Scott Pruitt still has a job because President Trump views him as a political asset. I think that there is some truth to this statement that his effectiveness is what's keeping him in his job. I just think that effectiveness means something different to the president and to, like, the general public. To the general public, I think effectiveness means that you've actually accomplished some policy goals. That's not quite true for Scott Pruitt when it comes to getting rid of environmental regulations. Scott Pruitt has started the process of getting rid of more than, or delaying or weakening more than 30 environmental regulations, but none of those have actually culminated in a regulation being repealed that was not already on hold by courts. What Scott Pruitt is really effective at right now is looking like he's effective and being really popular among Trump's base in coal country in West Virginia, in Ohio, and Pennsylvania. So I think that that's why the president is still holding on to him.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. There is this picture of him that a lot of us, myself included, have painted of his work there, that he's been very efficient, that he's, you know, cranked out these rollbacks like he's, I don't know, some sort of baker on a donut assembly line or something. But, you know, there's this debate about whether or not that's true or how effective these have been. I'm just wondering if you could tell us more about that.
Sure. I mean, like I said before, Scott Pruitt has started the process of repealing or weakening more than 30 environmental regulations, which is an impressive feat on his own to even started that process. The problem is, as I pointed out, the New York Times pointed out, Politico pointed out, he's been going so quickly that the legal efforts behind them, these are all legal processes because every regulation is justified by a law, either the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act. And you can't just repeal them without a reason. And so because he's doing it so fast, a lot of legal experts are saying that they're actually based on sloppy legal reasoning that will eventually get overturned by courts. And it's true that at least five or six of Scott Pruitt's actions have been overturned by federal courts. At least 10 of his actions to repeal regulations have been delayed by federal courts. I'm sure he'll succeed in some of these efforts. But for now, most of them are in jeopardy. And some of the big ones, for instance, pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement, that's something that Scott Pruitt convinced the president to do and something he's widely credited with. But we're still in the Paris Agreement, actually, and we will be until 2020, the day after the next presidential election. So it's not that Scott Pruitt hasn't done anything. He certainly has done some things at the EPA that will have consequences, particularly the way he's been reforming how science works at the EPA. But I think the point is just to pump the brakes and say this is more of governing by press release than actually implementing policies.
Yeah, I want to go back to that science piece. So you've written about this. He's trying to change the way the EPA uses science. And you've suggested that this should be more of a scandal than, say, I don't know, a bulletproof desk request. And part of me is wondering, are the scandals of Scott Pruitt, are they in any way connected to his sort of, you know, political agenda? Or are these just kind of garden variety, guy gets a lot of power and abuses it sort of unthinkingly and gets in trouble for it when people find out about it?
Well, look, the scandals that Scott Pruitt is embroiled in right now surround misuse of money, having sketchy relationships with people from the industry. And I think that those manifest two ways in his actual policy agenda. Scott Pruitt has always had a close relationship with people in the industry, and that is how he's built his political career and how he's gained such high standing. Now he's the administrator of the EPA. It's the best known secret in Washington that Scott Pruitt would like something higher one day, perhaps president, perhaps attorney general. And I think he intends to leverage his political connections to do that. And right now, those connections are to large Republican groups and industry players. When those are the people that you're courting, that you're taking rental deals with for a condo, then those are the people that you're going to want to do favors for. In the case of environmental protection, those aren't the people that need protection from pollution. Those are the polluters. Scott Pruitt's scandals inform that he may not be protecting the most vulnerable people in our society. The other part of that, I think, is well illustrated by an opinion article that New York Times former environment reporter Justin Gillis wrote the other day. Scott Pruitt has been, for his entire career, lying, that's Gillis's word, about climate change. He's been casting doubt on the science, whether it's human-caused, whether climate change is really harmful to people. And he characterizes that as a lie, because we all know that anyone with common sense knows that climate change is real and it's harming people. And his argument is that if Scott Pruitt, who's in charge of protecting the most vulnerable people in our society, is willing to lie about the problem that's going to impact the most vulnerable people, what else is he willing to lie about? That's his job, is to protect those people. So I think we have a larger problem than just, you know, spending money on first-class flights.
Emily Atkin reports on science and environmental politics for The New Republic, and she spoke with the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier for our podcast, Trump on Earth. There's more at trumponearth.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. How do you get volunteers of all ages to participate in a conservation science project on cold, windy nights for hours at a time? The promise of really cute owls. For our series, Wild PA, Andy Kubis spent a couple of really chilly nights with a team of volunteers at Project OwlNet.
Does it matter if I use the broken or the uncut?
So I'm Bob Mulvihill, ornithologist at the National Aviary. I'm out here at Sewickley Heights Borough Park to try to measure the migration of the northern saw-whet owl.
Have you ever seen a saw-whet owl? If you see one in person, you're going to fall in love with them. 3 inches tall, maybe. 2 to 3 ounces in weight. Just cute. Absolutely cute. So name is Joe Lee. I'm a birder, a mushroomer, a nature type guy. I've been here maybe 6 or 8 times.
Well, you can move over that way some, because that's going to be the turn and you go 2 nets.
I follow the guidelines of Project OwlNet, which is a more or less organized, more or less consistently formatted project. This is done by erecting mist nets and putting a collar that broadcasts loudly the bird's advertising call, which is actually a monotonous string of toots, and then just waiting.
Okay, my name is Sue Ralston, and I'm out here because I love the owls. We'll walk up there every, I want to say like 40 minutes. We got them check the nets. And then if there is an owl up there, we bring it down here. Bandit takes the data, and we can get a little pet in. And and it's just awesome to see it.
My name is Doug Consolo. The first 10 nights we were here, we caught no owls. It was brutal cold. Then we moved the nets, brought them closer, and we changed the call. And lo and behold, one of the owls was in the net. The oohs and ahs and tears just were everywhere. It was just that special. That owl was just the cutest thing ever, and soft.
The pure joy that people experience in being close to this kind of a research project. Sometimes I pick a child out of the crowd and that child becomes the tree, and I perch the owl on that child's arm, and then the owl releases from the child's arm.
Just like that. Say, my name is Alina.
Alina Margaret Sakura. I'm 6 and a half. I've actually released one on this arm, I think. And my mom and me had to hold up my arm because the owl didn't want to leave. And finally, my mom gave it a little nudge and it went away. They have really sharp nails.
Well, it looks like it's midnight. Let's go do the last check.
When people come out here, it's a grand adventure. We just line them up. They have their headlamps on. We go marching out. If we catch an owl, that makes for the best possible night. So, and it only takes one owl. One owl makes for a lot of happy folks.
Anything, Vic?
No owls.
No owls.
We have gone from knowing absolutely zero about the status of the northern saw-whet owl in Allegheny County to knowing that they are regular fall migrants, and urban green spaces like our parks can be important to something like a species of owl that nests in the remote boreal forests of Canada and all the way as far west as Alaska, I think is a good thing to find out.
I'm going to miss coming out in the woods at night. It's pretty neat, especially when you find owls.
Birds migrating north in the spring tend to move more rapidly. They're more urgent. Could be that they are flying over, but they don't have time to waste coming down to investigate a call when they know they've got hundreds of miles farther north to go. The owls are free to go. They're free to pass through now.
That audio postcard about the National Aviary's Project OwlNet was produced by Andy Cubis. Their project of banding migrating northern saw-whet owls will start back up again in the fall.
All right, until we all meet again.
More stories in the Wild PA series, head to our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation.